I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the heart of the Middle East, where NATO nation-backed nuclear-armed Israel continues its war on Iran and continues to massacre starving civilians in Palestine. Tomorrow, NATO's 2025 summit opens in The Hague, where the man they're backing, Netanyahu, is a wanted man for genocide. At the summit, U.S. vassal states will reiterate support for their puppet regime in Ukraine as part of a war on Russia ahead of plans to destroy China. Some of NATO's collapsing economies met in Canada at the G7 last week, which turned into the G6 after Donald Trump would not even meet with invited dictator Zelensky. In Canada, where an entire parliament applauded a Nazi SS officer with Zelensky, the G6 stood united in their backing for Israeli violations of the UN Charter. Meanwhile, Russia has just concluded its 2025 St. Petersburg Economic Forum, where the focus was South-South cooperation, not escalation, trade, not war, growth, not genocide. All this against a backdrop of escalation, with NATO intelligence-coordinated attacks targeting Russia's nuclear weapons infrastructure as well as Russian civilians. Joining me now from Moscow is a former colonel in the Russian military intelligence services. He is a member of Russia's Foreign and Defense Policy Council, Dr. Dmitry Trenin. Dr. Trenin, thanks so much for coming back. Before we get to Russia-Ukraine, I know you've written important papers on the changing nature of strategic deterrence. Why is Russia not entering the war on Iran's side, given the Russia-Iran Comprehensive Strategic Partnership Treaty signed just a few months ago? I know that Wang Yi is being quoted as saying, he spoke to the Omani foreign minister, that China cannot sit idly by and let the region slide into an unknown abyss. I'm not sure what China means by that. But what about Russia?
Well, there are reasons for Russia's behavior in this conflict. You're right. Russia and Iran do have a treaty on strategic cooperation, strategic partnership, that was signed at the beginning of the year. However, the treaty does not contain a clause that would have obligated the parties to come to the defense of each other in case either of them is attacked. I believe that the Russians were proposing this clause when the treaty was being negotiated, but Iran at that time demurred. I think they still put some weight on the potential outreach to the United States to resume the nuclear talks with the U.S. and get some agreement with the U.S. And maybe they thought that too close connection with Russia would not help them very much. But Russia has wider interests in the region, and those interests do include Israel. Israel and Russia have had, in the post-Soviet period, a fairly close relationship. Israel, despite being an ally of the United States, has not joined the sanctions coalition against Russia. So it's not considered an unfriendly country, unlike so many countries in NATO, Europe, the United States, Japan, and several other nations.
Sorry, you believe the denials that they didn't send air defense systems to Zelensky in the past few months, which had been reported by an ambassador, an Israeli ambassador, and then denied by the Netanyahu government?
Well, I've seen that. Certainly I don't have independent information on the state of the systems, what was sent, where it was sent. These things are murky business, and it's something that is difficult to track unless you have some very good information. But Israel has been, I would say, unlike so many countries in Europe, it's still been open to doing business with Russia, communicating with Russia. And that is something that the Russian leadership certainly values, as the Israeli leadership values for its own sake. And Russia, in that situation, is in a position to talk to both sides, which President Putin did when he just at the time of the when the war broke out between Israel and Iran, he spoke both to the Iranian president and the Israeli prime minister, and actually to Donald Trump at the same time.
And you believe Trump when he said that Putin offered to mediate between Iran and Israel?
Well, I don't know what words Putin exactly used in his conversation with Trump. As far as the Russian side is concerned, I've only seen one report of their talk, and that was a few days ago at the start of this whole thing.
Some might think it's unlikely because Russia's been obviously condemning, like all the countries in the GCC and the whole of the Global South, the UAE, where I'm speaking to you from, has condemned the breach of the UN Charter, the act of aggression
Israel. Yes, it did. Right. But Russia, at the same time, talks about the diplomatic solution, political solution, as the only way forward. And in order to have that wanted diplomatic solution, you have to have the two sides talking to each other. And if Russia can facilitate that conversation, then the principled attitude of Russia to the Israeli action would not matter all that much. This is your principled position, but your other position is that you need to talk. You need to bring this to conclusion.
I mean, I was about to say Iran then shows a complete naivety in thinking it shouldn't have signed a mutual defense pact within the Russia-Iran Comprehensive Strategic Partnership treaty like Russia has with North Korea, because it still believed that somehow Washington would be an honest broker. But in this case, isn't Russia being naive in not understanding that Iran and the United States are joined at the hip?
Israel and the United States. Well, yes, they are, but I would say that Israeli politics and Israeli policies are, let's say, a bit more nuanced than the policies of so many NATO allies that the United States has in Europe. So I don't think there's naivety here. I don't think that Russians do not see the things that they don't like in Israel, in Israeli policies. But there is also this this positive side to the relationship. I think that Israel is one country in that part of the world that still believes that the Red Army did a heroic job during the Second World War that should never be forgotten. Israel is one of the countries where the 9th of May, Victory Day, is celebrated by the...
Okay, well, I understand that historic appreciation, but, you know, there are lots of reports that Israel is aiding Ukraine to kill Russians, and certainly Israel is completely close with the United States, which has been behind the proxy war, which has killed so many Russians. I mean, that's the kind of naivety that was displayed by Russia in Minsk.
I don't think it's naivety. No, I don't think it's naivety. There are countries with which Russia does business, like Turkey, or countries that that purportedly have very close relations with Russia, like Serbia, and both countries have been supplying Ukraine with military equipment, with arms, and all that. This does not preclude Russia having relations with Turkey, because it's an important country and it's a trade customer for Russia, and it's one of the routes through which Russia can get things. Import things that it cannot import otherwise. There are many ways that in which Turkey could be useful to Russia. So you do not have to. There are no saints in international relations, and there is no one who is completely clean. There's always a trade-off.
But do you think it's clear that the attack on Iran fits neatly for those who want to destroy the dreams of BRICS and a multipolar world that Putin, Xi Jinping, Lula, Modi, all these different Global South leaders have, destroy Iran, turn it into a failed state. And that's an important element in hurting BRICS. India, of course, has that North corridor, trade corridor that's in development.
No, absolutely. No, no, there's no question about that. And hence the condemnation. But then you ask yourself what you should be doing. And for Russia, let's say things like collapse of the regime in Iran, its replacement with a pro-Western regime. If, you know, this is a fantasy, of course, but this is a fantasy that's been promoted by Israeli officials. So if you think in those terms, then you would be most interested in helping stop the war and help reach some sort of an agreement that would legitimize the Iranian nuclear program. Yet again, while making sure that that program does not lead to Iran actually acquiring nuclear
weapons. On that very subject, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, very clear that for theological reasons, Iran wouldn't want nuclear weapons. I'm sure you're aware that there's a huge desire within Iran now by the Iranian population, against the wishes of their so-called supreme leader, to want nuclear weapons. If they had had nuclear weapons, they could have helped, perhaps prevented these attacks by European, UK,
that's most
US.
Likely that.
Bombed Iran. So is Russia going to change its view? I mean, clearly there is now going to be proliferation of nuclear weapons.
Well, proliferation of nuclear weapons has been going on since nuclear weapons were first invented. We now have 9 countries that have nuclear weapons. Iran was in the category of a threshold state. Maybe it was not looking for actually getting a nuclear weapon per se, but certainly a capability to produce nuclear weapons. Iran, I think, was looking for deterrence. Unfortunately, it never got that deterrence before it was attacked. And I take your point that in order to protect your sovereignty and in order to protect your independence from outside powers, you need to have nuclear weapons. Well, getting those weapons is a hard thing, particularly if you're at odds with the United States or its allies like Israel in this case.
Dr. Dmitry Trenin, I'll stop you there. More from a member of Russia's Foreign and Defense Policy Council after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the former director of the Carnegie Moscow Center and now member of Russia's Foreign and Defense Policy Council, Dr. Dmitry Trenin. Dr. Trenin, we were talking about the nuclear proliferation implications of the United States, British, European-backed Israeli attacks on Iran. But do you not feel that a lot of people in the Global South feel there is this kind of slowness to act and continuous reactions by the burgeoning new world of BRICS and multipolarity? I mean, clearly China, it's much more important energy-wise for China, any loss of Iran to Syrianization. Do you not think that perhaps it might be China that acts first in this? I mean, it reflects also on the fact that it was so slow, Russia was so slow to realize the Minsk process was a load of nonsense. They were lying, the European powers and the NATO powers. Similarly, they're waiting for this to play out and they keep watching China, Russia, the supposed new multipolar power structure of this century.
Well, I think we should be in the clear about what BRICS is and what BRICS is not. BRICS is not a bloc. It has no hegemon. It has no single leader. Within BRICS, there's a wide range of views on a lot of issues. There are some countries that have very difficult relations between them, say India and China. There are many things
maybe
about
I mean Shanghai Cooperation Organization.
If you talk about the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, there's also Pakistan. And India and Pakistan have just had a short war, two nuclear powers. So there are many issues within BRICS that need to be sorted out. But in principle, this is not an organization. So it's both a strength that makes it, let's say, more attractive to a lot of people, and it's an open organization, or it's an open format or open platform, but at the same time, it doesn't act cohesively, and it's not a bloc. So that's the nature of BRICS. Now, Russia has been, I think, active diplomatically. I'm sure with both the participants in this conflict, Israel and Iran, but also with the United States. This is, if you like, Russia's contribution to hopefully ending this war sooner rather than later, and preserving Iran with a right to continue with a peaceful nuclear program. Now, China has made some statements. I hear that some Chinese aircraft or Chinese rather wide-body airplanes have traveled to Iran, and potentially they may have brought something to Iran. So there's something that's going on. But Iran, unfortunately for itself, has been caught on the back foot. Iran was, you talked about naivety a few moments ago, and Iran, when this attack happened from Israel, was getting ready to sit down with the United States for another round of Iranian-American conversations on the nuclear issue. So there is very probably deception employed by the United States that certainly knew in advance about Israel's decision to attack Iran. And Iranian, attitude toward the United States as potentially, if not an honest broker, then a country you need to sit down with and reach a deal with. So there are things that need to be taken into account. There are lessons to be learned from all that, as Russia did learn from the Minsk process that you mentioned.
And yet Russia seems to be talking to the United States again as if nothing happened. I mean, Trump is only going to be in power for another, he's facing midterms in a year's time. And who knows who will be the president then? Is it a case, actually? I mean, Sun Tzu said, let the enemy destroy itself. I happen to be looking through the life expectancy figures. You know, in South Dakota in the United States, life expectancy is about 66.8. In Yemen, it's 69.3. In Gaza, on October 7th, it was 73.5. In Cuba, obviously 80. In Iran, 77. In North Korea, 73. Is Russia, is China, are these countries, do they see that the United States is going to implode on itself by the contradictions within its own system as the gap between rich and poor reaches untenable circumstances?
Well, I always say it's going to be a long wait. If people wait for the United States to implode, collapse under its own weight, under the weight of its domestic issues, domestic problems, they're entitled to that, but it's going to be a long story. And in today's world, every single day counts. You see how many things have happened just in the last week, how many twists and turns, how many ruined expectations, how many surprises, and all of them have been shaping the world in which we actually live day by day. So another 15 months for Donald Trump with the American Congress in the present configuration may be a long way, a long time, and actually let's not forget the most important area for Russia in geopolitical terms is not Iran, but Ukraine. And in Ukraine, Russia is pressing ahead slowly, but it's a continuous movement, and Russia has been inflicting fairly heavy cost on Ukraine for the things that the Ukrainians have been doing in Russia or against Russia, and
there are NATO analysts even now saying and admitting the advances of Russia. But then you look at Ukraine deploys AI in drone warfare to destroy Russia's strategic bombers. What was your first reaction? Do you think Trump knew about it?
And well, I think he did.
What are the implications of the nuclear strategic bomber fleet of Russia's damaged in violation of any kind of START treaty, which expires anyway next year?
Well, first of all, we don't know exactly what was hit. And of the things that were the planes that were hit, which can be repaired and which cannot be repaired. There have been conflicting reports about that. There was no authoritative statement, nor would I expect one from the Russian Ministry of Defense. In any event, this did not do irreparable damage to Russia's power of deterrence. It was a daring act. It was an attack that surprised a lot of people. It led the most people here to believe that Ukraine was materially aided in all that by the West. First of all, the United States, and many suspect the United Kingdom being also complicit in all that, which basically led the people to rethink their attitude to deterrence, because you mentioned the treaty. Now, the planes were on full display as part of the treaty obligations, which essentially provide for both the United States and Russia being able to monitor through their national technical means, i.e. spy satellites, the strategic bombers that each country has. Now, these strategic bombers are mostly in the open, and they can be...
They have to be on display. But the point is, there is no Russian deterrence, is there? MI6, the British, as you say, no one is frightened of Russia, and therefore it is strategically comprehensible to understand why it is they can act the way they do. They can fund Zelensky, their proxy, and get the Ukrainians to hit Russia wherever, whenever they want to, and kill as many civilians as they want to, and even, as you say, violate this agreement, which actually arguably guarantees the peace of all of us on Earth.
Well, I wouldn't go as far as you have to say that Russia is a sitting duck for the Ukrainians to hit anywhere, anytime. I think that Russian air defense systems are operating fairly competently, and I cannot give
they
you
hit,
a percentage.
They actually hit strategic nuclear bombers.
I mean, of the Patriot
they're not doing very well, are they, if they can hit the nuclear-armed strategic bombers?
We're dealing with a situation in which, just like in Iran, Western countries have come up with this technique, very risky, very dangerous technique of using platforms shipped surreptitiously within the target country and being used as a platform to launch.
It's an Israeli technique used in.
Israeli technique used against Russia and Iran, or maybe Western technique. I don't know, frankly, I do not.
But the point is there's no deterrence.
Anyway, but both Israel and the West are cooperating very closely on that issue. And I think that in this country, Israel is not considered to be a prime adversary, but certainly Western powers, the United States, the United Kingdom, and several others, are considered to be essentially belligerents. So I think that the world has been saved fairly bad things by seemingly infinite patience of one man, and that is President Putin. He has his own reasons for behaving the way he has been behaving. He believes, and I think he is right in believing that Russia is winning the war. And although the nuclear doctrine of Russia has been updated and nuclear threshold has been lowered, Putin is anything but trigger happy when it comes to nuclear issues. However, I very much agree with you. This is the point I've been making all along in this country. Russia should have hit back so many times, and not hitting back at the main adversary, which is not Ukraine, has a tremendous price attached to that. If you fail to do something, then you're inviting your adversary to take another step and to be even more provocative than he was in the first place. So basically, I think that the policy is not so much of the US at this time under Trump, but the policy is pursued by the UK, France, and Germany, are bringing Europe much closer to a nuclear strike from Russia. First, maybe not nuclear, but a strike, let's say, using a Nareshnik missile against the territory, against targets in NATO territory, in Western European countries' territories. But eventually, if things go in that direction, we can rise to nuclear. And I think that the people in those countries do not understand the dangers that their leaders have been creating. And I'm really concerned with that. Putin's, I said, Putin's patience is infinite. I'm not sure that he would be prepared to take a blow after blow after blow, not hitting back at the source of trouble. And the source of trouble is in Western Europe now, increasingly so. So I worry. I very much worry about the future.
Dr. Dmitry Trenin, thank you. That's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those bereaved by the UK-US-EU armed genocide in Gaza. We'll be back on Saturday with a brand new show. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.